This podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
Is any patient population more vulnerable than children? Developing therapies to meet the needs of pediatric patients has always featured unique challenges, including and especially with respect to clinical trials. Even so, much progress has been made and continues to be made on behalf of the world's children. The Diamond Session Progress in Pediatric Therapeutics will explore this progress at our DIA 2017 Global Annual Meeting in Chicago. I am Alberto Grignolo, editor of DIA's Global Forum. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Ronald Portman, Executive Director, Pediatric Therapeutic Area for Novartis Pharmaceuticals Corporation, who will chair this Diamond Session. Thank you for your time today, Dr. Portman. Welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
FDA published in 2016 a status report on the Best Pharmaceuticals for Children Act, BPCA, and on the Pediatric Research Equity Act, or PREA. What were the most encouraging findings in that report, and was there anything discouraging in that?
I think I'd like to start that answer by giving a little context to it. I think that when I practiced pediatric nephrology as a professor at the University of Texas for several decades, it was very frustrating that the medications that I was using had all been developed for adults and had never been formally assessed in children. Society in general basically sent a very strong message to Congress saying that they no longer would tolerate this, that we needed to protect our children through the use of research and not from research, and that treatment of children individually, what we call an N-of-1 treatment, was no longer acceptable. And Congress responded initially with legislation in the late 1990s, the FDAMA legislation, which then over a period of time became permanently passed just a few years ago, BPCA and PREA. And they have led to tremendous positive impact on pediatric drug development. And this, along with the European legislation that was passed in 2007. But the job is far from done. And this report to Congress in 2016 really highlights the very positive effects that these laws and the European legislation have had on pediatric drug development. What was encouraging is the amount of pediatric research that has been done. We've had over 600, more than that now, labelings, pediatrics. They're not always of the quality that we want, but we have certainly learned over the years how we can do a better job of clinical trials in pediatrics, which, as you say, are extremely challenging. The other thing I want to focus on that's not necessarily reflected in the report is the tremendous change that we've seen in the collaborative spirit between the various stakeholders in dealing with pediatric drug development. When I first entered this field after academia, there was a tension between the regulators and people from industry that maybe we didn't have the same focus. And that certainly has been dispelled over the years. I think that we all recognize that we have one goal, and that is to provide well-tested drugs for children. And the spirit of collaboration between the FDA, EMA, industry, and now parents and academia has really been amazing and has led to some very positive things.
If I may, getting back to your days as a pediatric nephrologist in Texas, what do you think the industry or the regulators had not focused on drugs for children, perhaps assuming that children were small adults and all you needed to do was reduce the dose for pediatric use? I mean, why wasn't there an earlier focus on drugs for children?
Well, it's clear that children are, in fact, not small adults, that it's not just a size issue, that it's an issue of maturation of organ systems, different functioning of various physiologic parameters, different diseases that children have in different manifestations, even within the same disease. For adults. So it's not just simply making a smaller dose for a child and expect to get the same effect. But I think people were quite frightened of using those drugs in children, of doing that research. And they somehow, even parents, seemed to rather allow a physician to use their own experience and figure out a dose to give their child, even though there was no evidence for how to use it, rather than being involved in a research study. I think that we've come a long way since those days, based mainly on this legislation that has basically said we need to study these drugs in children, that it's required, and that in fact there's even an incentive to do so. And that has changed the whole paradigm, so that now every single drug that comes into the clinical space is considered for children. I mean, it's not always appropriate to test in a child, but I would say that the great majority are in fact appropriate and are being tested for children.
In the FDA report that I referenced, did you find anything that was less than encouraging or even discouraging?
I think the report basically shined upon the really good work that has been done so far and less on some of the discouraging aspects. But toward the end, there were some issues that were brought forward where we have a lot of work to do, work on innovative study designs, work on making sure that the studies that we put forward are in fact feasible, that we can actually do them. You may not be aware that the average time between an approval of a drug for an adult and any kind of labeling for children is 9 years, 9 years delay. And that hasn't really gotten any better over the past 4 or 5 years that we've been looking at this. So we have a lot of work to do. One of the questions is what is the data that we actually need? Are there ways to accelerate finding this data, some dosing data, some safety data, getting the drug to the clinicians earlier, and then continuing our regulatory required studies once the drug is out there and available? We need to be more innovative with some of our tools, such as extrapolation and the use of Bayesian techniques, which I think both regulators in industry and academia are really pushing for now. And I think we're going to have some really great breakthroughs in the next few years in how we do pediatric studies. We also have recognized that we need to have sustainable clinical trial networks. And I know we're going to talk about that soon, but that's something else that was pointed out in the report.
This is a gap of 9 years or delay of 9 years between adult labeling and pediatric labeling. What do you think drives that? Are companies not interested in pursuing pediatric labeling? Is it difficult to recruit children into clinical research? Is it a combination of those? Are there any other factors?
Sure.
You work in industry now. Perhaps you can offer that perspective.
Yeah, it's multifactorial. You know, there's no question about it. I think that we are now attending to pediatric concerns much sooner, driven by the regulatory requirements. We're looking at pediatrics now at the end of phase one and certainly by the end of phase two. So we're beginning to prepare some of the earlier stages better than we used to, and hopefully that will shorten things up for the time lag, such as preparing formulations, such as looking at biomarkers and endpoints for children and seeing whether they are the same for children as they are in adults, and then trying to identify where these patients are located and how we can enroll the various sites and network to get the trials done. We also have challenges in the academic community because there's very little reward for academicians to enroll one or two patients at a site. Because the diseases are, in fact, much rarer in pediatrics than in adults, we often have to enroll 100 patients in pediatrics. We may need to enroll 50 or 100 sites, and this is extremely time-consuming, and the number of patients to be enrolled at each site is very small, so that there's not a great deal of incentive for investigators sometimes to get involved in these studies, and it makes it very, very challenging to enroll the patients.
Building on that and turning to the practicalities of conducting pediatric clinical research, a number of networks exist that focus on pediatric therapeutic research. Could you perhaps talk about some of these networks and how they relate to or complement each other for the benefit of children and therapeutics for children?
The word network is one that's a word that's bandied about a lot, and it means different things to different people. If you look at the NIH alone, they fund over 80 pediatric networks, but the networks themselves are often loose affiliations of quite often academic sites that don't have any legal underpinnings. So they're all individual entities. So you still need to go to various sites and have a contract negotiation with each and every site, have a discussion regarding intellectual property with each and every site, have a different IRB approval for each and every site. And it takes sometimes, certainly 6 months is short, but a year, even a year and a half, to get a site up and running for a study. So having a well-functioning network is certainly something that we want to see. And there are such networks, but generally they're based on specific subspecialties. So, for example, in the cancer world, there is the Children's Oncology Group that is a formal network of 220 sites that is funded in large part by the National Cancer Institute. And one has to understand, while this is the granddaddy of pediatric clinical trial networks, it took 50 years to establish that to establish it as a well-functioning network. We also have networks in pediatric rheumatology, pediatric nephrology. In Europe, there are several networks, including national networks like the Children's Research Network in the United Kingdom, that are very efficient and work very, very well, but they don't encompass all of our pediatric needs, and many of them have not been sustainable. So there are two major initiatives underway, one in Europe through the Innovative Medicines Initiative 2, or IMI2, that will hopefully establish a children's clinical trial network in Europe. And that is in the process of being developed right now. We're in the midst of that, and we think that this is going to be very, very successful. It's a public-private partnership between industry and the IMI2, or European Commission, where industry donates in-kind donations, and it's matched euro for euro by the European Commission. So this is moving along very successfully, and hopefully by the end of this year, we will actually have an approval for the development of this network. And over the next 5 to 6 years, we hope to see that network developed. In the United States, we don't have a formal process to put together such a network, but it's being done as well. A couple of years ago, multiple stakeholders from industry, academia, FDA, EMA, NIH got together through the American Academy of Pediatrics with funding from pharma to hold a major symposium that basically concluded that a sustainable nonprofit pediatric network was needed in this country that could become global. And funding was provided from various pharmaceutical companies to the Critical Path Institute that helped us develop a network, which has now been established. And this was announced last week, I believe. This network is called IACT, which is IACT for Children, which stands for the Institute for Advanced Clinical Trials in Children. And this is a nonprofit network that is currently seeking funding to launch and become a sustainable trial network for pediatric drug development. These two networks in Europe and the U.S. will plan to work together collaboratively to be able to do the same protocols for drug development in both parts of the world. And Japan and Canada are also joining this effort. So we hope to see this spread to be a global pediatric initiative.
As you mentioned, the word network sometimes is applied to lists of sites that are not really affiliated with each other in any formal way, right? So sometimes right. The word network is misapplied.
Yes, that's right.
Whereas the formal networks that you describe have efficiency associated with how they operate, right? Efficiency in a network is kind of the essential element of a network, isn't it?
Well, it is. And the keys to it not only are its sustainability of the network, but to have similar scientific capabilities of all the sites that are involved, a legal underpinning so that a single contract can be negotiated with a central administration that can then deal with all the member sites. So there'd be a one-stop shopping, if you will, that we involved patients and caregivers in the development of the protocols, that we have a uniform IRB process, that we have a budget template so that all of the sites are accepting the same or very similar funding for patients that are enrolled within these sites, that there's pediatric education of the people who are carrying on these studies that can be brought forward to enhancing research at all these sites for their faculty, their fellows, their residents, that we have a uniform e-clinical system for the data entry for adverse event reporting, and that there be performance measures for the various sites to make sure that they are performing up to the standards of regulatory trials. So all of these things will be incorporated in these new networks that we are putting together. And it should be a major step forward for accomplishing pediatric research.
Well, you've just listed a number of very clear benefits, for example, single contracts, single budget, single IRB approval. Are these benefits still aspirational, or are you already seeing some evidence that some of these benefits are in fact being put in place and delivered, or is it all still in the future?
These are part of the plans for these networks that are being developed. The IMI2 network and the IAC network have this in their plans. They are still not yet functional networks, but they're being built with these benefits in mind. Some of the other networks that I mentioned that are very, very successful networks actually have these features already in them. But of course, they're limited by, for example, in the COD network, it's limited by the fact that it's an oncology-only network. So if you have a drug for a pulmonary disease, that you're not going to be able to use COD. In the UK CRN network, they have most of these features already in their network. But again, it's only one country. It doesn't take the global picture into account. So we've learned from these networks what are the effective features of a network. And now we're trying to build these new networks to be able to apply them globally.
So clearly these existing successful networks have provided, if you will, proof of concept that these benefits can be designed, put in place, and leveraged in clinical research. Fair enough?
Fair enough.
As these networks are going global, if you will, what do you see as the key challenges in taking them global or making them global networks?
Clearly, in the United States, we have different challenges in that we're only one country. We don't have a unified healthcare system that makes setting up these networks very challenging. Each site is its own healthcare system, if you will. So it will take time to bring all of these together in a unifying network in the U.S. In Europe, through the IMI2 process, we will be able to bridge the differences between independent countries' healthcare systems because they are all signed on through this IMI2 process to collaborate. Once we bring on other countries, such as Japan and Canada, which very much want to be involved and are developing their own networks, then we're going to have to learn how to interact with these groups. Another major area that I might mention is the fact that if you look at FDA-approved pediatric studies and where the patients come from, fully 25% of the patients that are enrolled in these studies, even though they're studies for the FDA, come from South America. So it's a very rich area for pediatric research, and the physicians in South America are very interested in doing this research, and we hope that they will ultimately be involved in these global networks. And that includes also places like Australia and New Zealand, which are very much involved, and we're hoping that countries such as China and India will come on board as time goes forward.
It strikes me that one of the determinants of the ability to enroll children in clinical research is the parents' willingness to let their children participate in clinical research. What are your thoughts about that? Are there any cultural differences? Are there disease-specific differences in parent attitudes towards this?
Yes, all of those things. As a parent, you know, you want to have a drug that is being given to your child to have been fully evaluated in the pediatric population. But your initial feeling is, but evaluated in somebody else's child, not mine. And so it's sometimes difficult because they're very concerned about their child to be, quote, guinea pigs, end quote. So I think that we as a society have a lot of work to do in educating parents that doing drug development through research is actually very beneficial to their child, and not only their child, but children in the future. You know, the kids are amazingly altruistic. You talk to a child about being involved in a study, and they're actually amazed. You can see their eyes grow wide, and they say, gee, you mean if I participate in this study, what I do might actually help other children? They're so excited by that, and they're like, yeah, sign me up. I'm ready to go. And it is remarkable. And you know, the parents are remarkable as well. I mean, they're very engaged. And of course, there are many, many advocacy groups that parents have gotten going to try to help their children and foster research. Some examples, of course, is the oncology community, which has many, many parent groups that are pushing very avidly for more research to be done in pediatric oncology. There are any number of rare diseases where there are parent groups. The Cystic Fibrosis Foundation is probably one of the key paradigms for groups of parents who have come together to form a highly effective foundation that has fostered research in their area and contributed in major ways, both financially, organizationally, finding patients to be involved in these studies. The Juvenile Diabetes Foundation is another group that has been very avid in pulling research together to benefit their children. So it has been a tremendous partnership and is growing even more so with the initiatives that both industry and academia and regulatory agencies are saying, you know, we really need to get patients and parents involved with the design of these trials very early on. And there are initiatives from Europe called the Young People's Research Group, and in the U.S. and other countries, a group called ICANN, which is an international children's advisory program that is trying to become very organized in helping design protocols, design assent forms, consent forms to try to make research more feasible in pediatrics.
This ties into the movement around patient centricity and, more importantly, patient engagement in clinical development, clinical research. Very, very interesting.
Exactly.
Both the U.S. and Europe have requirements for the development of pediatric drugs. In your view, what are the differences between them, and do they present challenges to this development of pediatric medicines? Are we making progress towards convergence of regulatory requirements for pediatric medicines?
So, yes, it is very much of a challenge. I think the underpinning is that they are more alike than they are dissimilar, but that doesn't mean that some of those dissimilarities don't make the research very challenging. There's definitely been a convergence. The time toward considering pediatric programs used to be very different. European regulation required it very, very early on in development after the end of adult phase one studies or PK studies, whereas in the U.S., it was the pediatric considerations were really due at the time of the NDA, so really at the end of adult phase three. So there was a sometimes years difference between when those things needed to be considered. The U.S. In its most recent passage of FDASIA had changed that. So now we have our pediatric program is due 60 days after the end of phase two, which, to be honest, is the most appropriate time to be bringing our pediatric programs to the regulatory agencies. And I think these have come much closer together now between Europe and the U.S. The European agency, the EMA and the FDA, have cluster calls every month, or sometimes even more frequently, to discuss differences or problems that they see in various pediatric programs. And that's been very successful. What has been less successful is that industry, which is bringing these programs forward, are not really involved in those discussions. That's a frustration for industry, and that we still have to negotiate completely separately with Europe and with the FDA. And sometimes we just can't come to an agreement, and we wind up having to do more than one study because we can't gain that agreement between the two regulatory agencies.
There's a mechanism called parallel scientific advice that is available to industry sponsors to speak to FDA and EMA at the same time. Should industry make more use of parallel scientific advice for this purpose?
Yeah, it's not quite so easy because the scientific advice paradigm, if you will, is not built into the pediatric group on either side of the Atlantic particularly well. So that system hasn't been used as much, and I'm not saying it shouldn't be, just saying it's not. And I think it's something that has really more prolonged the process than really helped it move forward. So it hasn't been a particularly successful thing for pediatrics. There's one other difference that I might highlight, which is a major difference between FDA and EMA, and that's the issue of feasibility for studies. The FDA, in its regulations, has a waiver criteria that if a study is really not feasible, they can grant a waiver based on that, whereas the EMA does not have that as a criteria. And so sometimes we're required to do a study in Europe where we're not in the U.S., and that sometimes is a major challenge, particularly if the FDA doesn't want the study to be done in the U.S. because they feel that there's some issue related to safety or other issues, and then we have to try to do that study only in Europe or in other parts of the world, and that makes it very much more challenging.
Have you found that FDA in those situations will accept European pediatric data for purposes of a labeling approval?
I think that's a case-by-case basis. Each division in the FDA, I think, you know, handles that question differently. And I think each study. I know of instances where data that has been gathered in other parts of the world have been utilized and accepted by FDA, and other situations where that's not been the case. So I think it's a case-by-case basis.
Dr. Portman, we're out of time, and I want to thank you for your time and insights today. Much appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you.
For DIA Global Forum, I am Alberto Grignolo.
To learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.